Support for the Capital Connection comes from New York State United Teachers, working to support students, educators, and public schools as the center of their communities through the Public Schools Unite Us initiative. It's the Capital Connection. Hi, I'm David Gustina. Joining us this week is Chris Gilardi, criminal justice investigative reporter for New York Focus. New York Focus is an independent nonprofit newsroom investigating power in the Empire State. It was launched in October of 2020 and publishes in-depth journalism that explains how the state really works. And I've talked to a few journalists now from New York Focus and am very excited to talk with Chris Gilardi today. Again, the criminal justice investigative reporter. You can find out more at nysfocus.com and read all of his work and so much more. Chris Gilardi, thanks so much for joining us on the Capital Connection this week.
Thanks so much for having me. Great to be here.
Yeah, the big news as we speak is that President Donald Trump has targeted bail reform. And his latest threat, says the title of your article, to New York's federal funding. And in the subhead, New York's bail reform law didn't eliminate cash bail and hasn't led to increased crime or recidivism. The Trump administration is still targeting it. Now, bail reform has been a big fight for the Republicans for a long time. And even some more centrist Democrats, including Governor Hochul, wanted to work on things like discovery and, of course, bail reform. But the issue was always that so many folks that didn't have the funds would be stuck in jail and couldn't get out. So it benefited those with money. And now you weigh in on the fray. What does your article point out?
So, yeah, like you said, Donald Trump is targeting bail reform. I should just put it out there and clarify, this is a nationwide executive order that he signed this week. And it does, the executive order itself doesn't specifically call out New York. It gives Attorney General Pam Bondi pretty much power to create a list of states or localities or other jurisdictions where she thinks more or less they've like eliminated cash bail systems in such a way to jeopardize public safety. So it doesn't just call out New York, but Trump himself and his administration have called out New York's bail reform law many times, including in recent weeks. So we know that he has New York in mind when he signed this and is threatening to sort of withhold federal funding if New York and like other states that may be on Pam Bondi's list doesn't change their bail laws. So what our article points out is that pretty much Donald Trump's executive order, if he's targeting it to New York, that his administration has mischaracterized what has actually happened with bail reform in New York. So, and that is two main things. One, he is calling out jurisdictions that have, quote unquote, eliminated cash bail or substantially eliminated cash bail. And that applies to very few jurisdictions across the country. In New York specifically, what bail reform did is it barred judges from imposing cash bail or like cash collateral as a condition for a release from jail pretrial for most misdemeanors and some low-level felony offenses. So cash bail is still an option for a majority of felonies, including pretty much every violent felony. So New York did not eliminate its cash bail system. It's still there. It just reined it in for low-level offenses. Another thing that the article points out is, Trump and his administration and his allies in Congress and elsewhere have said that bail reform in New York and elsewhere has led to increases in crime, that it's led to increases in, like, recidivism or rearrest, so that it is leading to people being released and getting arrested over and over and over for the same offenses. New York is a giant state. Of course, that happens occasionally and definitely has happened. And his administration has pointed to like the most egregious cases they can find as sort of proof of their claims. But all of the available studies that have been done show that on a systemic issue, what bail reform in New York and across the country in the other places that have put in similar bail reforms, what it has done has actually either decreased rearrest rates, because scholars actually point out that pretrial detention actually increases risk of rearrest, or it has had no statistical effect on crime or rearrest. Like every study that has been done, every like thorough study that has been done so far has shown that. So yeah, what his administration is saying about increases in crime and increases in recidivism being tied to bail reform just aren't true.
Yeah, and between those studies you just cited and the crime statistics we see that show crime in almost every category going down, and, you know, the takeover of Washington, D.C., the threats to Chicago, he's even mentioned New York, is all part of a Republican strategy that four Republicans and conservatives have worked over the years, and that is the Democrats are soft on crime. But based on Governor Kathy Hochul's moves, you would think she was going in the opposite direction. She was going more towards being tough on crime.
Yeah, I frequently describe Governor Hochul as a tough on crime Democrat. You know, she is not completely anti-bail reform. You mentioned discovery earlier. She's not completely anti-discovery reform, but she has expended a lot of political capital in rolling back those reforms and in funneling more money to law enforcement and more resources to law enforcement. So specifically, like when we're talking about bail reform, in multiple state budget processes, which is where a lot of the state's most important legislation happens, not just fiscal stuff, but all sorts of legislation gets passed through the state budget every spring. She tied up state budget negotiations in order to force through rollbacks to bail reform. One year, she like forced through legislation that gave judges greater discretion to keep defendants incarcerated and to set bail in certain cases. And in the year prior to that, she pushed through legislation that made like new types of charges, including some new misdemeanors and nonviolent felonies, bail eligible. So yeah, she's been pretty tough on this issue, despite what her Republican critics have charged.
She's also brought the National Guard into the New York City subway system.
Yeah, yeah. She's gone hard on the subway issue as well. I think that's actually a really good indicator of where she and other sort of politicians are at on the, you know, quote unquote crime issue. Again, there hasn't really been much statistical evidence to show that throwing more cops and more National Guard in the subway does much to decrease crime in the subway. But yeah, she's sort of like along those ideological lines where the more cops, the better.
Yeah, and it makes sense for a governor just because politically, you never want to be labeled as not trying to reduce crime and using every bit of your capital to do it. But one of the things that strikes me once again and is indicative of the kind of journalism work that New York Focus is doing, and we're talking with Chris Gilardi, the criminal justice investigative reporter, is that we're constantly fighting misinformation. So in one example in your article, you point out that Trump incorrectly claimed that radical left New York City Council adopted no cash bail. That's not true. It's a state law.
Yeah, I think just the way that Trump has gone about bail reform is a great case study in how his administration and I think his allies and his movement in general assert things and come up with policy based on feelings rather than facts. The statement you just cited is a great example. So, you know, Trump is going after bail reform. He says, as I've explained incorrectly, that it is leading to increased crime and leading to increased rearrests and, you know, that criminals are running amok on the streets. He doesn't even have the facts of what the law is correct. So that statement you were just citing, he said that the New York City Council is what passed bail reform, which is incorrect. It's a state law. It was passed by the state legislature in 2019. He said that New York adopted, quote unquote, no cash bail, which, as I've explained, is incorrect. New York still has a cash bail system. You just can't set cash bail for low-level charges. And that it, quote unquote, started the problem. And the problem he's referring to is an increase in crime. And that's, you know, wrong on its face in two ways. One, because crime in New York City, as it is across the country, is decreasing. And as I mentioned, studies that have been done on New York's bail reform have shown that it has had no statistically significant effect on the crime rate, and that the crime rate, you know, it goes up and down for a number of reasons. This is a point I generally like to make when I'm talking about politicians trying to attribute increases or decreases in crime to various policies or whatever they want to blame or to brag about. crime itself is incredibly difficult to pin down when you're talking about causation. It's actually pretty impossible. Scholars talk about this all the time. And therefore, like, crime statistics are pretty fungible. So if crime is going up, then there's a whole set of things you can point to that it's going up, even though it's sort of impossible to track, and vice versa. Of course, Trump is saying that any sort of increases in crime are the result of policies that he doesn't like and policies that his administration is targeting.
Yeah, and if you think about it, as a political strategy, he's got all the bases covered there. I mean, he can claim what he wants to claim because he's trying to get the base riled up. So in New York, for example, by going after them on this issue, he is helping, potentially, Elise Stefanik, the congresswoman, who looks like she's going to be probably running for governor. So, and she's echoing how great all of his points are. And the idea here is, who cares whether the truth is there or not? We'll use the information to our benefit and rile up the base so they get out and vote. Hopefully we'll win.
Yeah, absolutely. As you mentioned, Stefanik, who seems to be almost definitely running to challenge Hochul next year for governor, immediately put out a statement. Well, it was funny because it blamed Hochul for bail reform, even though Governor Hochul isn't the one who signed bail reform into law. It was Cuomo. And even though Governor Hochul has forced through rollbacks to it multiple times. I think your point is not to use a cliche, but the political polarization I think that we're seeing at the moment, I think Republicans are going really hard in really riling up their base as much as possible, facts be damned. And yeah, that seems to be their strategy.
Well, I want to move on to another subject. We're speaking with Chris Gilardi, criminal justice investigative reporter for New York Focus. You can read Chris's work and so much more at nysfocus.com. Now, the wonderful thing and how I ended up reaching out to you is that I was watching John Oliver's program Last Week Tonight, in which he picks a theme in each show. And one of the more recent shows was about gang databases and explaining how names end up on a gang database that eventually gets to ICE and is used by ICE. And guess whose article was cited in that program? Yours, Chris Gilardi. That's right. Your article titled "The New York State Police Are Feeding ICE a Gang Database." And it was a remarkable program because what you begin to learn is there are some pretty feeble reasons that don't stand up for why someone might get on a gang database, including for wearing a Chicago Bulls t-shirt.
Yeah, it's pretty remarkable what can get you on a gang database. Appreciate the shout out from John Oliver. I highly recommend that episode. It's a great program in general, and that episode really gets at the heart of what the problem is with gang databases. Not to get too in the weeds and not to get too historical, but gang databases have been a thing for a long time, decades. You know, they started in California and made their way sort of like as standard law enforcement practice across the country. And they generally use very, very similar criteria that allows law enforcement to add people to them. And that criteria is very tenuous. As you mentioned, specific types of clothing can be evidence that law enforcement can use to add people to gang databases. The most, I think listeners may recognize the name Tilmar Abrego Garcia. He's the most relevant and in the news example of this. The reason that the Trump administration is going after him and that ICE has been going after him dates back to years ago when a police officer in Maryland added him to a gang database based on his Chicago Bulls hat, which is supposedly linked to MS-13, to the Central American gang, and a sweatshirt that he was wearing that apparently also had a logo or an insignia that can be tenuously tied to what the officer described as quote-unquote Hispanic gang culture. So yeah, it's extremely tenuous. I've been reporting on gang databases for a long time, both inside New York and outside New York, and I can say pretty confidently that most use similarly tenuous criteria to add people to them. What is alarming is that they're very secretive, and we don't know the extent of how many law enforcement agencies have gang databases, how many people are added to the gang database, who is in the gang database. Like, if you're in a gang database, there's no way of sort of knowing and no way to appeal your inclusion in it. And that was highlighted in the story that you mentioned that we wrote back in April on the New York State Police. A lot of people know about the New York City Police Department's gang database. It's been very controversial. It's going through a big fight. People want to abolish it. But what nobody in the state really seemed to know is that the New York State Police have their own gang database that other law enforcement agencies add to, and they've been operating it actually for longer than the NYPD's.
Yeah, and as you point out, that information goes right to ICE, as the governor, Governor Hochul, of course, is saying, we're not going to cooperate.
Yeah, so Governor Hochul, you know, she is not sought, I think, to totally close off New York from cooperation with Immigration and Customs Enforcement. She's actually said pretty forcefully that people convicted of certain crimes should be handed over to ICE. What she has said is that her New York State Police are not going to cooperate with ICE, not going to feed information to ICE, not going to, you know, cooperate in raids and stuff like that. But there are all sorts of ways that law enforcement agencies can cooperate with ICE without actively doing so, I guess is the way I would phrase it. Because there are all sorts of information sharing agreements that have been in place for years between state and local law enforcement and the federal government, there's constantly information, like sort of passive information flow between those two entities. And ICE can take advantage of that very quickly. So in the case of this state police gang database, we see the New York State Police, you know, compile this gang database. Now it has like 5,000 members. It's been in place for almost two decades. And what they do is they upload that gang database to this FBI-run clearinghouse. It's called the National Crime Information Center. And what the National Crime Information Center is it's like a big repository for all sorts of databases. There's like sex offender databases. There are wanted databases. It holds a lot of stuff for and then disseminates that to law enforcement across the country. The idea being that if like some police officer in one state pulls someone over and runs their name through this clearinghouse, then they can see if they're wanted in another state or if they're like a missing person, things like that. So the New York State Police upload to this FBI-run clearinghouse, and FBI feeds that directly to ICE. So ICE now has direct access through the FBI as sort of like a middle person to the state police gang database. And this is true for a number of gang databases. I recently did a story for The Intercept trying to like track which law enforcement agencies across the country upload to this FBI sort of middleman. It's really difficult to track, but it's true for a number of agencies across the country. So we see all of these like sort of passive ways that law enforcement can be cooperating with ICE without the public even knowing.
That's Chris Gilardi, criminal justice investigative reporter for New York Focus. Read more of his work at nysfocus.com. I'm David Gustina, and you're listening to The Capital Connection. Chris, there's so much to talk about with criminal justice. Let me start here, and that is we witnessed beating death, and we've seen more than one of these. And that beating death of Robert Brooks at the Marcy Correctional Facility was followed by a strike of prison guards over conditions in the prison. Kathy Hochul threatened them, said you have to get back on the job. If you don't, you'll be fired. Subsequently, many didn't. I guess 2,000 were fired. It's what the Corrections Commission is calling a severe staffing shortage. And amidst all of this, the prisoners themselves have suffered. And what I mean by that is when it comes to solitary confinement.
Yeah. So long story short, the prison system is in crisis. And if you're talking New York State criminal justice, this has been the story of the year. It is quite a saga, and episodes keep unfolding as the year goes on. As you mentioned, the sort of the beginning of the saga was the killing of Robert Brooks at Marcy Correctional Facility, is a 43-year-old incarcerated man. And the reason it caught fire is because it was actually caught on video, caught on body cams. The officers thought the body cams were turned off, but they weren't. And the attorney general got hold of that body camera footage, showed it to the world, and it sparked a nationwide controversy and definitely a statewide controversy. The state prison system faced what I would describe as like more scrutiny than it has in many years. And just a couple months after that, as you know, the prison commissioner was getting a lot of questions and putting a lot of reforms in place in response to the video, the corrections officers went on strike. The timing of their strike, I think advocates are charging that the timing of their strike is suspect. It happened shortly after, I think, a few of the guards in the video were charged with murder. And a lot of people are describing the strike sort of as a way to sort of take back the narrative. Obviously, you see guards beating an incarcerated person to death, and you think a certain thing about guards. I think they were trying to take back the narrative insofar as they have long complained about unsafe working conditions themselves and have long complained about understaffing, even though New York prisons have like a very rich corrections officer to incarcerated person ratio if you compare it to the rest of the country. Whatever the case, their strike really caused chaos in the prison system. It lasted for 3 weeks. And as you mentioned, after those 3 weeks, as they returned to work, 2,000 of the guards didn't return to work and were promptly fired. So there was staffing concerns before the strike. With 2,000 guards fired, there is now what the prison agency is describing as a staffing crisis. And that is what the prison system has been dealing with since. So you mentioned worsening conditions for incarcerated people. With fewer staff, the prison system has pretty much been in a state of what I describe as like pseudo lockdown ever since. In a lot of prisons, I'm hearing constant reports, and this has been reported in lawsuits as well, that incarcerated people are locked in their cells or in their dorms if they have sort of like congregate dorms for upwards of 20, 21, 22, 23 hours a day. And that's just not good for a person. It creates a lot of tension in the prisons.
Yeah, and Chris, and when you add in the summertime, which your article points out, there is not air conditioning where the main jail cells are. So many of these incarcerated folks are sitting in blazing hot conditions. You cited a heat average of 109 degrees in one of the cells. So, you know, sitting there in the heat is not good with no air conditioning in these prisons.
Yeah, it really shows how this strike is making emergencies out of issues that have been rampant in the prison system for years. So yeah, with the exception of a few medical units, there is no air conditioning in places where incarcerated people are in New York prisons. Both advocacy groups and watchdogs and incarcerated people themselves have complained about this for years, but generally you can get some relief if you're out of your cell, if you're outside, if you're in a slightly cooler part of the prison, if you're in a place where there are like big fans.
And you can buy a fan for $20.
You can buy a fan for $20, but the size is limited. They're only a few inches long. They're like little personal fans. One guy who is at Sing Sing Correctional Facility was telling me that it's barely enough to like cool off his face, let alone his whole body. And he's got to like hold it up right next to him. And incarcerated people and watchdogs describe cells themselves as kind of like hot boxes. There's really bad ventilation. The only like sort of industrial fans are in the hallways, and they have, you know, these little slit windows. They're made to not let someone like fit through if they're able to like saw through the bars or something to prevent escape. So the ventilation is really bad. And so, yeah, we have incarcerated people just like sitting in these hot boxes for upwards of 20 hours a day, which, you know, is a health concern, first and foremost. It's a human rights concern. It's also just like a safety concern. I think some incarcerated people are describing to me how, and this totally makes sense, right? Like heat, I can't think of something that would make me angrier and to like raise tensions between me and someone who is watching over me more than just like being hot constantly. So it's really been a bad situation this summer, especially for the state prisons.
You know, it dawns on me, Chris Gilardi of New York Focus, that the reason this has been going on so long is that, you know, many of us, and I can hear the listeners out there, says, who cares? Gosh, who knows what one of these people did to someone, what crime they committed? Let them overheat. We don't care. But that really says something about us as a state and as human beings when we don't treat these folks like they are human beings with some compassion, at least. They're already serving time and they're being punished. So do we really need to punish them more?
I really appreciate you bringing up that point. It's something that I think about quite often and something I try to address in my articles. I mean, there's two ways to sort of respond to it. One, and the way I think about it is, yeah, these people are being punished for things that they were convicted of already. They've already lost their freedom. They've lost their liberty for a set amount of time, some of them their entire lives. There's no need to keep them in inhuman conditions on top of that. I also hear an argument, which I am very sympathetic to and I think is pretty useful from people, where unless they're in prison for their entire life, and even if they are in prison for their entire life, ostensibly what we say is that prison and incarceration in general is supposed to be a rehabilitative experience. It's not just for punishment, but people are supposed to go there. They're supposed to atone for what they did. And they're supposed to become better people. It's really hard to do that when you're in a place where the main thing that you have to worry about is how you're being treated and whether you're being treated like a human being. You know, it's very hard to go through rehabilitative processes when you're constantly concerned about abuse by corrections officers or whether you're going to overheat in your prison cell or any number of other complaints I hear about constantly in the prison system. So yeah, I mean, you can have the thought that, oh, these people committed a crime, so, and they're out of sight and deserve to be out of mind. I would argue that it really says something about the way we treat all of our people, that we're willing to treat incarcerated people in this way.
I could go on and on and on, and I hope you'll come back and we can talk more about criminal justice as it pertains to New York State. I tell you, I'm having some excited delirium right now. Oh, that's a teaser, because there's a whole there's a whole issue around a condition which police are still training on in New York, which has been debunked as not a real condition. Excited delirium, that is. But we'll have to wait till next time. Chris Gilardi, what a pleasure. Criminal justice investigative reporter for New York Focus. Read Chris's work and all the reporters' work at nysfocus.com. Chris Gilardi, again, thanks so much for joining us on the Capital Connection.
Thank you so much. It's been really great.
Support for the Capital Connection comes from New York State United Teachers, working to support students, educators, and public schools as the center of their communities through the Public Schools Unite Us initiative.